Hello and welcome to another edition of the Ice World podcast with me, marine biologist Nadia Frontier, featuring conversations I recorded in Antarctica whilst working with the British Antarctic Survey. This time we meet geneticist Professor Melody Clark and ecophysiologist Dr. Simon Morley as they talk about the effects of human activity on antimicrobial resistance in native species, the thermal tolerance of Antarctic invertebrates, fisheries management in South Georgia, and individual contributions to climate change, and a surprising amount about limpets. That was a mouthful, so I hope you're ready for a jam-packed episode. I met Simon and Mel via Zoom in the COVID period in 2020, where together we planned the projects I would conduct at Rothera. I then finally got the chance to work with them in person 2 years later in the 2022-2023 summer, where these interviews were conducted. I interviewed Simon in the microscope room in the Bonner Laboratory at Rothera, where we had just been looking at small invertebrates under the microscope. Simon, can you introduce yourself and tell the listeners about your background, please?
Thank you. So I'm a marine biologist. I've worked with British Antarctic Survey since 2001, largely as an ecophysiologist, so looking at how animals have evolved to life in the Southern Ocean, how they cope with the variability in their environment, and how they're going to cope with long-term change.
And how did you get into this line of work?
At age 11, I started fishing with my next-door neighbours. And that got me just absolutely, excuse the pun, I was hooked. So since that day, I've been interested in fish, and that got me into fish biology, marine biology, led me through to my PhD, which was in fish physiology. And then that got me interested in temperature and temperature effects. And that led me through to working in one of the coldest places in the ocean. First posting was to King Edward Point, where I was the senior scientist at the newly opened, at that time, fisheries laboratory.
Were you quite a pioneer in fisheries research in that way?
Yeah, so there'd been a groundfish survey. So the kind of research vessel had gone around South Georgia doing sort of periodic surveys to assess the fish stocks. So we brought in crabs from the fishery and looked at their reproductive biology. And in fact, we looked at reproductive biology of many different fish. There were the grenadiers, which are the kind of rat tails, and various of the shallow water fish. The bays around King Edward Point are a nursery ground for some of the notothenioid fish, so some of the fish that were heavily exploited in the 70s and 80s. And there was a big question about whether they were recovering. Our time there, there were very few fur seals in the bay, but the population was recovering because, of course, they were hunted almost to extinction in the 1800s, and the population was recovering and exploding, and they were starting to come back into the bay. So how would they affect this nursery grounds? Only just in recent years are we seeing signals that these fish species that were heavily exploited in the 70s and 80s are actually coming back, which is
really
a long time for them to come back.
Wow, interesting. So how did you find working alongside the South Georgian government at that time as a marine biologist?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. Yeah, it was such a great opportunity. So we came in, you know, we were the first into the lab when it reopened. So we set up the labs, we set up the aquarium, we set up the protocols and a further kind of that early stage of research. Of course, it's evolved and developed into something quite different now. But and from my perspective, to be working within a fishery and helping to protect that fishery, provide the data to make sure that the sustainable catches within that fishery is, you know, it's great.
Absolutely crucial work. Yeah. And how many were in your wintering team?
So there were three scientists and then another five or six people on the station. So
It's a tiny team. And you stayed there for two winters.
Yeah.
Without a break.
Yeah. Well, I did get a break. I got a month on the fishery survey around South Georgia. So I didn't leave South Georgia.
You didn't actually go home.
No, I didn't go home. No, okay. Absolutely not. No, we didn't. In those days, we stayed for the full 2 years.
Two full years.
Yeah.
Did you get to go to Bird Island in that time? Have you seen Bird Island?
I didn't get to Bird Island in that time, but a few years after I wintered, I was on a research cruise that was diving around South Georgia, and we went to Bird Island and did some research with a good friend of mine who was doing intertidal research, so research on the near shore.
After your winter at South Georgia, what was the next step after that?
So after that one, I had my year in Cambridge writing everything up, and we got our 6 papers out at the time, which was really good. And then this job came up as a physiologist, which has got me this current role here. So a physiologist working down here. So this dive cruise I talked about, we did a dive cruise at South Georgia at Sydney, and then we collected animals here, and we compared the physiology of these animals across that latitudinal gradient from the warmer subantarctic in South Georgia down to here. True Antarctic.
So. What did you find?
So, interestingly enough, the big finding was with the limpets. And the big finding was that South Georgia, these limpet species are actually pretty close to their upper temperature limit. And actually, physiologically, they were not as robust as the ones down here. So they were actually like really kind of hanging in there in the summer at the edge of their temperature limit. So most of the work I've done is I've warmed the animals up, so you gently warm them up and you look at how that affects their biochemistry, their activity, and ultimately their survival. And so you can look at lethal and sublethal effects of these animals and how then you can use that to predict how they're going to cope with future scenarios of climate change.
And can you tell me your coolest limpet fact?
My coolest limpet fat.
They're your favourite invertebrates, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess the limpets here on the shore, they're the only limpets I've come across that can actually turn themselves back over when turned upside down. And you think about it, if you lived on a shore that was frequently scoured by ice, it'd be better to not hold on and be knocked off by a piece of ice than to hold on and be crushed by it. And so if you get knocked off and can turn yourself back over, then you hopefully won't be eaten by the predator when it comes along, because you'll be able to protect yourself with a shell. So,
what are your hopes and thoughts about the future of the Southern Ocean, honestly? Are you optimistic?
I am optimistic about humans and human society making that change. So what I'm not optimistic, or what I'm not sure about, is whether we will make that change in time before it's too late, before we've reached various tipping points. So it's fairly clear that there's an economic imperative, and that will only get stronger for us to be working in green technologies, to be reversing the CO2 emissions, and to be coming up with mitigating measures against climate change. The question that remains unanswered is, will we be able to reverse it before we've lost certain things? 1.5 degrees for the Southern Ocean is manageable. 2.5 degrees, you start to lose some of the critical habitats. Sea ice starts to reduce to such low levels that potentially you start to lose species. Personally, I'm optimistic we will get there in time. All of us can reduce our carbon footprint. We can all do that. You know, we can buy an electric car, maybe not an electric car, but a smaller car. We can cycle to the shops. We can walk to the shops. We can recycle. We can volunteer with nature reserves that are, you know, protecting bits of our habitat. There's so many things we can do as individuals. And then the broader aspects are about influencing policy. I regularly write to my MP, and I normally get a response. When there's an issue, you know, when there's an issue about habitat destruction, or, you know, one of my local nature reserves that's at risk of being developed into a housing estate, for instance, I will write and I will make my voice known. And actually, excellent. Normally, if you do it in a very reasonable way, you can get some good responses. They are your elected officials, whether you choose to vote for them or not. And they do answer to you as the people in their borough. So there's a little nature reserve in Essex where there's the only location in the UK for a particular species of, funnily enough, orchid. Yeah, so I'm sorry, but that's one of my hobbies. And many of us wrote against the planning application, and it was blocked and it was still being discussed, and in the end, and I've not got that confirmed, but I'm pretty sure it's now been designated as a SSSI site of special scientific interest, and will therefore get legal protection. So the garden in our home, we took out the lawn and we have a wildflower meadow. You know, we have a pond in the back garden. It's tiny, but it's a pond. It's a different habitat. We are creating biodiversity, or habitat for biodiversity, in our tiny little patch of a garden. Everybody can do it.
Nice. Well, thank you very much, Simon.
No, thank you.
Thank you. I'm here with Professor Melody Clark, geneticist working with the British Antarctic Survey. We are in the 2022 Rothera summer season. And Mel, you have come down here for a short period of...
2 months.
2 months.
Yeah.
Wow.
So with 2 weeks quarantine.
Yes, with 2 weeks quarantine. That does add a lot to it. Can you explain to me what you have been doing this season?
Well, this season I've been concentrating really on microbial work. So we've started a new project looking at antimicrobial resistance. And we have an interest in understanding how humans living in Antarctica have the potential, because obviously we have antimicrobial resistance genes in our bodies, and worldwide antimicrobial resistance is a real problem, how that may be passed on to animals or the environment in Antarctica, because it is essentially a pristine environment. And the question is, can we actually pass antimicrobial resistance genes on to animals, or maybe, you know, vice versa?
Do you expect that we will be able to do that?
There's no evidence as yet. We've just published a review, which is due out soon in the Microbiome Journal, that there's no evidence as yet. There is some evidence that E. coli strains that are prevalent in a clinical setting have been passed on to animals, but at the moment there's no evidence of antimicrobial resistance being passed on. But the data are incredibly limited. There are very few studies and everyone seems to have used different methods. So what we're trying to do is a pilot study here, really just to see, to develop the kind of methodology and try and develop some kind of standardisation.
And how are you conducting this sampling? What's your method?
Basically, really exciting field work, like going to the sewage treatment plant, the outfall of the sewage treatment plant, the intertidal near the sewage treatment plant, and various places around Rothera, sampling the soil, the sediment, the biofilm. And I've been doing some sequencing on site with the Oxford Nanopore Technologies MinION. I've just done the sequencing. I haven't got any results as yet. But the other samples I'm taking back to the UK, and we'll be working them up in the UK just to identify those. But the results will be some time coming.
That's really interesting. Could there be a case that the animals have also evolved the same antimicrobial resistance gene that humans have? How can you actually tell that it's humans that have passed it on to the animals?
That's a really good question. It's really difficult to work out. There is actually quite a bit of evidence that even though we think of it as a pristine environment, there are actually lots of antimicrobial resistance genes in the soil and in the marine environment already, simply because you have very limited resources, particularly in the soil, and it's a kind of defence. So if you've got antimicrobial resistance genes, you become stronger than the next microbe in the soil. So there's a level of endemism of antimicrobial resistance genes already. But basically, if you're finding resistance to synthetic antibiotics, it's most likely to be human in origin.
It's a very interesting project. And what else have you been doing this summer?
When I first came down to Rothera in 2006, and I work a lot with the divers, we had two main species of cucumber that you'd find everywhere. So there's Heterocucumis and Cucumeria. So a black one and a pink one. And then a few years ago, we started noticing that we're getting one or two more of a dark pink one that looked slightly different. And we set up a study to look at the gut microbiome of a number of marine invertebrates. And we included all three of these sea cucumbers in that experiment, really to try and look to see if the microbiome can potentially affect the resilience of those animals in the future. But we didn't have the thermal tolerances of this dark red cucumber. And now we've seemed to appear to have two more cucumbers, one of which I believe you discovered with this kind of rather kind of bag-like pink thing.
Yes, very and then buoyant, and you can always see the internal contents of the sea cucumber, yes.
So there's that one, and then there's also one that we've nicknamed the naked mole rat
cucumber. And it appears to incorporate almost sediment particles into its skin, it looks like.
Yeah, it looks kind of a bit weird for a cucumber, but you can see the tentacles at the end, so it's definitely one. So it seems as though, purely on an anecdotal front, that at least the sea cucumber fauna is changing over time, and that maybe we're seeing more and more of these different types of cucumbers. And in terms of the thermal resilience study, it seemed that Solus, which is this dark red cucumber, the new one that seems to be arriving in huge numbers, is actually more thermally sensitive than the other two. So maybe its habitat was further north and it's moving further south. To be honest, there isn't that much data on Antarctic species in the databases, really. So we're kind of moving into whole new territory.
And if you find these new microbes from sequencing them before you understand their functionality, are you able to name them as the discoverer of these microbes? How does that work?
There is a naming convention. I'm not quite sure how it works. The only thing I know is you're not allowed to name it after yourself.
Yes, you can name it after somebody else, but not directly.
There are strict taxonomic rules, and I haven't even thought about that.
That's excellent. Yeah. What's your most iconic project that you've had over the last 16 years?
We've had some great projects. I think possibly my favourite is the limpet transplant experiment. So looking at methylation status in, methylation is a form of epigenetics. So looking at that in intertidal and subtidal limpets. And what we've got in Rothera is we've got this limpet called Nisella concinna, which is all over the place in huge numbers.
Everywhere.
And you get some in the intertidal, which have very pointy, very thick shells, and you have some lots in the subtidal, which have much shallower shape and much thinner shells. And at one point, they're thought to be two different subtypes, but they're a broadcast spawner, and we've actually proved that genetically they're the same population. Mm-hmm. And the question is, why do you get this difference, and how do you maintain it? So a few years ago, we came in and we did a transplant experiment where we had a kind of station-wide appeal for nail varnish to be able to paint these limpets, because we wanted to mark the limpets. And I do have to know which the most robust nail varnish is, because we've tried them all.
What
I can't say. But we got a whole bunch of intertidal limpets, a whole bunch of subtidal limpets, painted them different colours, put some back in their original place, and then moved the others back to the opposite place. And thought that in 2-3 months' time we'd go and collect them, and they started to go back where they came from. So after a month, we finished the experiment. But it was really correlative that you have very different gene expression profiles, or, you know, the things that the limpets are doing, or the proteins they're producing, are very different in the intertidal to the subtidal. And this is kind of stabilised, I guess, by epigenetics. It's a temporary effect. But
epigenetics, just for the listeners, is the switch on of different genes at different times. So those genes are always present within
genome,
but sometimes they're upregulated or downregulated.
It's a way of marking things temporarily so that you adapt to particular conditions. But it's a temporary marker. But it was great fun, because I ended up to my neck virtually trying to find these limpets as they're wandering back to where they came from.
So they actually, because they're adapted to that intertidal environment, which is constantly, the tide is going out, so they are then subject to desiccation and greater heat stress.
So they were supposed to stay where they were, but they didn't. Yeah. Which was very bizarre. So we had to go hunting for them. But in the end, it was a really fun result, and it was a great project. I really enjoyed it. I mean, we did a lot of sequencing on them, but we also spent an awful lot of time painting limpets with nail varnish.
Well, yeah. It's just... Can you talk to me about antifreeze proteins and the adaptations that Antarctic fish have to such cold waters?
Okay, well, they all have antifreeze proteins, and they have a specific type of antifreeze protein, which is an antifreeze glycoprotein. And this enables them to live at kind of -1.86, whereas normally, or if you had a North Sea fish and put it in the Antarctic, it would freeze solid. So they're able to swim in amongst the ice crystals. And the really interesting thing about this protein is that it's also present in Arctic cod at the north end of the planet. And it has the same identical three-dimensional structure as the one in the Southern Ocean, but it has a completely different evolutionary origin. So you've got this fantastic example of convergent evolution, where you've got the same problem, in fact, very cold environments, and nature's come up with the same answer in two very different regions of the globe where, you know, these fish would never meet. Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing example. And there are potential spin-offs, because if you understand how animals work in the cold and how proteins have adapted to work in the cold, you can look for cold-adapted enzymes. And the big thing these days is all about green energy and low energy solutions. And if you find enzymes that are very similar to the ones we currently use in industrial processes, but that work at low temperatures, you could reduce energy costs dramatically.
Very true.
I mean, it's a long shot, but it is a potential spin-off from the work.
My final question to you is, what is your favourite aspect of Antarctica? What do you enjoy the most about coming down here?
Staring out and looking at the icebergs. Really, it's just, the scenery is absolutely fantastic. On a sunny day like today, and you can just go out and just sit and watch the ice and listen to the ice.
Hear it crackling
is just beyond compare.
That is magnificent. Well, I wish you the best in your future projects. Thank,
thank
you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Simon and Mel are both Bass lifers, and this is the colloquial term we use at the British Antarctic Survey. This means that they have both made such an important scientific contribution and dedicated decades of their lives to working with polar animals that they will probably never leave Bass. People of all backgrounds and experience find their way to Antarctica, so perhaps your skills might be relevant too. Check out the job section of the British Antarctic Survey's website, where openings at the many bases are posted regularly. See if something catches your eye, and you too might become hooked, like Simon. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please do tell people and take some time to write a review. It really helps us spread the word. Next time, I'll be talking to the Defiant team, which stands for Drivers and Effects of Fluctuations in Sea Ice in the Antarctic, where we will learn more about how to measure sea ice from the air and from ground measurements. It's a good one. I'm Nadia Frontier, and thank you for listening.